Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
But I actually had someone say to me on social media that Dedham is 81% white. What about our rights?
Oh my God.
They're like, it's hard out here for it's hard out here for a MAGA, you know? Like, it also coincided with like Daddy Trump being, you know, having his pants taken off in front of
what exactly
what's really
is hard
crazy.
For him? Like, what can't they do?
Well, what's really crazy is that's the exact same echo of 1974 in Boston. Like, I'm like picturing this video I just showed to the kids where this white lady from Southie is standing at City Hall saying, "We're white. What about our rights? What the 14th Amendment applies to us, too." It's like, yeah, that's the point.
I was talking to this woman who grew up here and she said, I was like, was it always like so fucked up? And she was like, not until the 70s. She was like, in the 70s, right. There was a big white influx flight. Of people, right? White flight. So the angry people of Charlestown and South Boston were like, fuck off. And they moved to Dedham and then everything was quiet until this winter. And I had people telling me everything was fine until you libs showed up. And I was like, everything was fine. And like, for whom? We're talking about a curriculum that says, consider for a moment that the Native Americans may have had some standing to protect their land, right?
Well, no, it's also that race is a social construct, which is scientifically proven. I put up a whole thread on Twitter in response to Idaho State Legislature passing a law saying that they could ban it, and they put a rider on it to make it go into effect immediately. But it's the idea of race being a social construct that was invented in the 1700s, and then it didn't become a big worldwide thing until American slavery happened. And American slavery needed some type of justification for subjugating Black humans despite their Christian faith. So, yeah, Strom's also going to bring up the point that the reason for the city manager role was actually the KKK's influence in town during that 1920s wave of the KKK, and the fact that they were used to drum up xenophobia against Irish Catholics. I thought that part was just fascinating that, you know, as we've seen across the country, things like gerrymandering, things like the Electoral College, things like the filibuster all have a history of being used by segregationists and racists to stop progress from happening.
Mm-hmm. And protect capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely. To maintain that class structure and to protect capitalism at all costs. Good point.
Yeah, and that was kind of one of the coolest things about kind of all the protests this past summer. You know, the stuff was terrible that caused it to come about, but I think it made people a lot more aware and a lot more open to checking out like racist histories of public institutions. And ours in Portland has obviously a real recent one. And that hit home with a lot of kids at the protest. They actually took some of the protests to the city hall steps and asked for the city manager to resign by name specifically.
It really shows that the George Floyd protests and that kind of summer of Black Lives Matter really was an awakening. You know, it didn't turn into the transformational change that I was kind of hopeful for at the time. But slowly, I feel like, you know, especially in cities, folks are waking up and demanding really tangible reforms that are going to change the systems that have like kept racism and kept capitalism in place for so long.
Yeah, and importantly, in like the analogy of the protests of like the late 1960s, the Nixon campaign of like scaring white people and sort of essentially tricking them into voting for him in 68. That didn't work in 2020. I mean, they tried the thing and it didn't hold.
Right, it didn't.
Antifa is gonna invade the suburbs.
C-Money, could you get into a little bit more about how, I mean, Strim sounds like he was super popular, at least with the far left, but what was the campaign to get him out of office? Just so that our listeners have that going into this interview.
There were a lot of Democrat candidates. I don't actually even remember if we had even one Republican candidate for mayor. I don't think anybody is dumb enough to try that in this town right now. You know, it was a crowded field. There were a lot of newcomers that didn't have any political histories, so there was no baggage, so they could focus all of their intent on Strim's baggage, which I don't think was substantial. And I think a lot of it was because he had an intransigent city manager and a city council that wasn't really responsive in the way that he thought they should be. There's been a big housing crunch in Portland, and there's been a lot of development that hasn't addressed any of that. It's been largely like big artist condos and hotels going up, like WEX built a big center here, but we're still like super short on workforce housing. There's been a lot of gentrification going on in areas where poor people did live. You know, our food scene is really big, and that's kind of expanded out into those areas. And then housing prices have gone up in those areas. New buildings have gone up in those areas that are really exclusive. And I think a lot of people targeted Strim for that sort of stuff when it wasn't really necessarily his doing. It was more the way the Chamber of Commerce worked with the council directly to kind of implement business needs over the needs of people in the city. And I think, you know, in the interview, Strim lays out that that was a big frustration. I think ultimately all of the other Democrats harping on that stuff just kind of poisoned the well for him, unfortunately.
Another thing that listeners should know as we go into this interview is the fact that Portland is a city that is one of the most welcoming cities towards immigrants, with or without papers, in the entire country. And Strim's going to kind of show pride when he talks about that. And he just kind of beamed when I asked him about that. So it'll be fun to hear him explain why he feels like that's the right move for Portland. But C-Money, you had some thinking on like Portland and its longevity without that you know, lifeblood of immigration.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in this area. I grew up in a city called Westbrook, which is a suburb of Portland. So I spent a lot of time in Portland as a kid, and I've lived here my whole adult life, except for when I went to college in Boston for a little bit. But like back when I was a kid, the city itself, the main drag, Congress Street, was full of blight. It was full of shuttered storefronts. There was like open drug dealing, open prostitution. The whole Back Bay area of the city was totally undeveloped. It was all kind of junkyards and scrap yards that were ringed by like tenement housing, rundown places, stuff like that. We started to get an influx of immigrants in the mid-late 90s, I noticed that the town started changing. You know, Maine is like the whitest state in the country, so it's kind of easy to tell when that stuff is happening. The empty storefront started kind of filling up with different ethnic businesses. A lot of the genesis of our food scene is a lot of these ethnic restaurants that opened up then, and now Portland is known internationally as a great city for food. It's like a big part of our tourism draw is our food and drink. And I credit the immigrant community for that sort of stuff, you know, and I think that that's what a lot of this kind of controversial gentrification is being built on top of, is that kind of food culture stuff. So I do feel like immigrants are a huge part of this city.
But another thing that Strim is going to bring up, and it's something that I teach as a civics teacher, and when I teach it to my students, they always say, why isn't everything decided this way? And that is direct democracy. And Strim will talk about how, you know, the frustration from the fact that city council members who ran and were elected on issues that the progressive community wanted just would fail to get those passed. And so he finally, after he left City Hall, he kind of got together with DSA and started organizing. And what I think is most genius about his group, People First Portland, is that it's devoid of ideology. It is so myopically focused on the issues so that you can drum up a coalition, as he's about to, you know, really like flesh out. The direct democracy ballot measures are just a major engine for progressive change across the country. As we've seen, you know, California has state ballot measures. Massachusetts has gotten a lot done through the ballot measure. Legalization of marijuana, gay marriage, all of that stuff has happened through ballot measures. So I really think that's a fascinating piece, and that he gets it so well that he was able to to kind of just gather DSA folks and other groups to form those coalitions to get those measures passed.
What that made me wonder, I think that's super cool. I don't know if you guys know how this would work constitutionally, but let's say a state or a locality were to pass a law similar to like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act or something protecting trans youth because they seem to be under attack in quite a few places. Couldn't a conservative legislature or a conservative court, I believe Trump appointed something like 150 federal judges, couldn't they just simply strike down some of those ballot measures, or is a ballot measure have different standing than, say, like a piece of legislation?
So it's definitely different standing than a piece of legislation. So the courts, the federal judges you mentioned, only come into play if a law or a ballot measure is challenged. So they kind of clean up on the back end. The judiciary is meant to judge whether a law is constitutional or not. And so the ballot measures is really, I think, an engine for change. But once that, what happens is the ballot measure is written, then legislature does have to deal with it, and they have to go with the will of the people. So then they write a law, that addresses whatever it was voted on in the ballot measure. But once that law goes into place, then different interest groups can challenge the law on its face, or they can wait until there's a case that they can bring to court that involves some person who was wronged or harmed by the law, and use that, or a class action suit with a number of folks, to prove that the law is wrong, and they try to argue that it's not supported by the Constitution.
Right.
So another term that he might mention, and I want to make sure all of our listeners grasp it because I didn't spell it out in the interview, is the idea of NIMBYism. So anyone want to jump on that and explain to our listeners what NIMBYism is?
Yeah, NIMBYism is just it's an acronym for not in my backyard. It's kind of a shorthand for reactionary types, usually white suburbanites, who don't want provisions being enacted near them, like homeless shelters, like business zoning, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, they're fine. They're fine with these measures as long as it's not going to happen in their backyard. As long as they're not going to have a direct impact on their lives, they're all for it. And they love to get the chops, the credit in their local community for being oftentimes liberal. But when it comes push comes to shove, and they might actually see some suffering or some poverty, they are not in favor.
Or some of the NIMBYs we have here in Portland move near the airport. And then have a problem with planes flying over them. They don't want planes in their backyard.
Like, NIMBYism and gentrification seem to be like cousins a little bit.
Oh, sure. That's a great point. Absolutely.
One is more reactionary than the other. I would call NIMBYism like proto-Karenism, maybe.
Yeah. Ooh. I like it.
Okay.
You like that one?
So, Dan, you're pretty charged up about some of the talk in Washington about universal pre-K. Is that right?
Nothing gets me more fired up than universal pre-K. Well, actually, in all seriousness, this bill that's known as the American Families Plan that's currently going through Congress would essentially take us from a 12-year publicly funded education system to a 16-year, meaning they would add 2 years of pre-K and 2 years of community college. So I love it in theory, but in a world where Joe Manchin wields incredible power over the final price tag, I'm wondering what you guys think about it. Because as the bill is currently written, there's no income cap anywhere in the bill. So essentially, a single mom of four kids would be receiving the same benefit as a tech entrepreneur or a hedge fund manager. Like, how do you guys feel about that?
For me personally, I feel like putting sort of like means-tested caps on things is kind of like a neoliberal or technocratic solve to problems that don't necessarily exist. I just don't see like insanely rich people like rubbing their hands and like, finally I can use the government to send my kids to public school. You know, they're already paying for private school, like well above and beyond what any subsidy would cover. Like, I just can't even imagine them applying. It just seems like an artificial limitation.
Yeah, and I think any path towards universality in the pre-education, preschool plan across the country is going to be a net positive. You know, I've seen firsthand that the only time real changes happen in a school district or in a specific school, it's when white parents agitate for that type of change. And I think that if we had more, rich people or other, well-off anybody going to those universal pre-K programs and they didn't like what they saw, then they would make a pretty big noise about that, and we'd see some changes pretty quickly to those programs.
And I just think you can liken it to Social Security. Like, Social Security is universal. Rich people get Social Security too. Do a lot of them actually cash out on it, or does it make sense to limit that by like means testing it? I think there's a lot of power in universal measures like that, and it makes them kind of repeal proof after a generation.
Yeah, they pass a lot easier.
Yeah.
A couple of pretty staggering statistics that I was not aware of before I looked into this. Massachusetts, super wealthy state, very much known for education, really high taxes relative to some other states. Only 50% of children attend preschool. And so you can use your own judgment to figure out what types of kids, which demographics are in that number. But that seems remarkably low.
Yeah, and what's striking about that is when my first experience working full-time on a political campaign, and right when I graduated from college in 2006, I worked for 4 months full-time for Deval Patrick's first gubernatorial run. And I remember the excitement he would get from crowds when he mentioned passing universal pre-K and preschool programs for everybody. And it just didn't get done. And it's shocking, Dan. It's a great point that only 50% of kids are enrolled in attending preschool.
The more troubling statistic that I found was that, sort of similar to Section 8 housing, there is a wait list for subsidized preschool. And currently only 20% of families who qualify, so in other words, the families who are on the list, only 20% actually find a slot. And the wait list for getting on that is about 2 years. So say your kid is 2, by the time they get off the wait list, they're pushing 5, which is kindergarten. So it's almost like one of those situations where you need to be putting your kid on the week after they're born. In a society where we say we value education, that can't stand.
Yeah, I don't think it should stand anywhere in the country, but you're absolutely right that it's a glaring problem if it's happening in Massachusetts. Yeah, so let's check out this interview with former mayor of Portland, Maine, Ethan Strimling, talking about education for low-income folks, immigrants being welcome in a city, progressive gains made at the city level, direct democracy, and how you can get measures that are supported by the vast majority of a populace passed by just skipping the legislature. Just check out this interview. He's got a lot to share. Our guest on this episode is former mayor of Portland, Maine, Ethan Strimling. Welcome to the pod, Ethan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. It's really nice to meet you. It sounds like you do good work. I listened to a few of your podcasts, so great conversations. I hope we're able to live up to it today.
Cool. Thanks for listening. I'd like you to start off by just introducing yourself to our listeners.
Sure. Let's see. I was born, raised in New York City. I grew up in the theater, actually. My father is an actor. My grandmother was an actress, and I was sort of going on that path. I went to the High School of Performing Arts, and then I went to Juilliard. And somewhere in there, I started to realize this was not actually the path I wanted to do. Politics was something that was very meaningful. Theater I loved. I loved political theater, but I felt like I needed to perhaps find a different road. So I came up to Maine, met a few, some folks who actually I'd known for a long time, lived with them, ended up going to school at the University of Maine, and then went off to graduate school and studied history and education. And from there, I came to Portland and was hired to run an agency called Learning Works. And Learning Works works with at-risk kids and low-income families, immigrants and refugees, and uses education as a tool to try to help people move out of poverty. And I ran that place for about 20 years, just a remarkable, remarkable organization. You know, there's just nothing that is more inspiring than seeing a kid who's dropped out of school or been in jail get their GED, or a new immigrant be able to become a citizen through your language classes, or a parent learning to read with their child. So very involved in the community and loved that work. While I was there, I ran for and served in the state Senate. And I served in the state Senate for about 6 years. And then I became mayor of Portland in 2015. And I served in City Hall from 2015 to 2019. And we achieved a lot of great work. I'm sure we can get into some of that stuff, but really just trying to focus on how to make sure that the working class in this city, people who are struggling on the edges, are able to get a fairer shake, create some more opportunities. It was great. And since I've been in City Hall, I've been doing a lot of work, which I know we'll get into in a little more detail here with People First Portland and Southern Maine DSA and all kinds of good progressive groups.
Great. So you actually mentioned something that I was planning to also talk about, which is my first, you know, positive regard for Portland came out of my wife's experience. She was doing an internship, getting her MSW at the Harvard Immigration and Refugee Center. And she found that when her clients were in between, you know, waiting for refugee status, they couldn't get services anywhere in Massachusetts. So she drove them up all the way up to Portland, Maine from Cambridge, and was able to get them a ton of help in your city. I'm wondering if you know, if those are some programs that you helped to make sure stayed strong or that you helped maintain while you were mayor.
Yeah, Portland is a very welcoming city, and we have made very clear we're not going to be checking your papers when you come in looking for food. We're not going to be checking your papers if you need a shelter. At Learning Works, where I was, we provided English language classes to anybody who came in. Again, we weren't checking anybody's papers on that. Human beings are human beings. You know, if you have kids who need to get an education, they go to our schools. And so maybe through all of that, she was looking at it and realizing that Portland is a good place to live. I'm encouraged to hear that. You know, when I was mayor, we had a number of battles. You'll remember when Donald Trump said that he was going to start sending all the migrants at the border to all the sanctuary cities. I, among many other mayors, stood up and said, bring them on. We're happy to take anybody you send our way because it's our lifeblood. You know, immigrants built the city of Portland. They're still building the city of Portland. And if we didn't have immigrants in this city, a third of our population would be, it makes us who we are.
Right. And as a teacher in Boston Public Schools, I have a large portion of students who are immigrants or children of immigrants. And whenever people ask, I tell them those are some of my most eager students. And the gratitude from those kids is just like mind boggling. So I hear you on that big time. So I requested an interview with you because a Twitter contact in Maine DSA asked me to help you spread the word about Progressive Portland Charter Commission and the candidates supported by that commission. In this effort, you're helping to coordinate the People First Charter, I believe. You've already used some of the names for this. I think it changed name at one point. Could you explain what this is and what you're trying to accomplish?
Sure. And so Progressive Portland is actually a separate organization that's been doing a lot of really good work. I've certainly worked with them. I'm not on their board or anything like that. They do a lot of local advocacy. People First Portland was a subcommittee that rose out of the Southern Maine DSA. And really, it rose up because, you know, when I was in City Hall for 4 years, while we got a tremendous amount done in areas around education funding, some property tax relief for low-income folks, some good environmental stuff, we really were not able to get through the kind of housing policy, the kind of worker wages that we needed to raise, kind of environmental policy, protections for immigrants. And we said, why don't we just go straight to the ballot? You know, one of my biggest arguments with the city council was always that this city is demanding more change than you are providing. The city wants us to be more bold. You're listening to simply the people who are coming into City Hall and Those are the special interests. Those are the lobbyists for the most part, instead of really hearing your constituents. And so we decided to go to the ballot, and we went to the ballot with five initiatives, which were to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and pay essential workers during the pandemic $18 an hour, ban facial surveillance technology by any government employees in the city, pass what we called a Green New Deal, which was modeled after the National Green New Deal. It basically had three components. First component was around environmental standards for buildings that had public funding. The next piece was around making sure that workers are paid good wages who work on those buildings. And then the third were stronger incentives to build more affordable housing. So like the federal legislation, it really focused on the environment, it focused on workers, and it focused on housing. And that was our third referendum. The fourth one that we had was rent control. Rent control was something that we had tried to pass in 2017, and it had failed pretty badly. But that was an off-year low turnout. And we knew that this was going to be a presidential year, a strong turnout, good opportunity. And the last one was restrictions on Airbnb. And this was to basically say, okay, Airbnb can exist, but only if you live in the unit, because we have 400 units in the city of Portland that have been taken off the long-term rental market and turned into short-term rentals. And for us, we have 17,000 units of rental units in the city of Portland. You take 400 units off, that's 2% of your market. And that's a big deal. So anyway, we decided to put these five referenda on the ballot. We decided to do all five at once. We said, look, you know, we can get the signatures. We have the grassroots. If we give the opposition the ability to just target one like we did with rent control, they can put all their money into that and kill it. This is a good way for us to get a lot of issues out there, get a good conversation. And, you know, honestly, we were like, if we can get a couple of these passed, it'd be awesome. And Election Day came around and four out of five passed with an average of 60% of the vote. And the only one we lost was the Airbnb one. And we lost that by 222 votes. So very close on that one as well. But it really proved the point that the voters of Portland, the people of Portland, are so much more progressive. And so that really is what formed People First Portland. But it was on the ballot in July, and you'll remember BLM really rose up last May and June, and BLM in Portland became very strong. And our current form of government, which we'll get into, was created by the KKK, and I'll get a little more into that later. But BLM said, we need to get rid of our current form of government, and called on people to reopen the charter. And the people responded with over 70% of the people said, reopen the charter. Now what we're doing is there are 20 plus people who are running for that charter commission, and we are doing everything we can to try to make sure that those are people who want real transformational change of our city government, who want to make sure that we create a true democracy that allows people to feel like their voices are heard and responded to. And so People First Charter is formed, and we are trying to make sure that we can get those folks elected on June 8th.
Okay, so June 8th is that election. That must have been such a triumph to have those ballot measures passed. Could you tell our listeners some of the more shameful details about the Portland Chamber of Commerce and what you would like done about that?
Yeah, the Portland Chamber of Commerce, unfortunately, has become very reactionary. They used to not really get involved in Portland politics a whole lot, and they were more sort of just a booster for businesses. But they have become much more active in trying to block change at City Hall. And the history of the Portland Chamber, so the business community back in the 1920s, back in the 1910s, actually, worked very hard to try to change our city government. For our first 100 years in the city of Portland, we had an elected mayor, and we had a council that sort of bicameral, two bodies, that had 36 people on it between the two bodies. Very representative. Lots of opportunity for people to participate. Lots of opportunity for you to vote for your neighborhood person, whoever you wanted, to make some noise. Well, the Portland business community at that time, the Portland Chamber, realized that it was very unmanageable for them to control that. And we had a lot of immigrants in the city who were becoming citizens that were all of a sudden getting the opportunity to vote. And at that time, it was the Irish and Irish Catholics in particular. So they tried to change the charter a couple of times to get rid of this elected mayor because they felt like there was too much power and get rid of this huge council and create a city manager form of government. Well, they failed twice. And then in 1923, they realized that if they wanted to get this thing passed, they really needed to jack up the xenophobia. And there was the KKK. And they were right there and said, okay, we're with you. We'll help pass this new form of government. And they leaned in, and the new form of government passed in 1923, wiped out what was a 36, two-body elected. They turned it into one body of five. And those five people, elected all at large, would appoint who they wanted to lead the city. And that is basically the same system we have today. That five has become nine, so not much bigger. We still have three or four at-large seats, including the mayor. And basically, the city manager is running it. And when I was mayor, you know, I felt and experienced those problems through and through. You know, you're the mayor of the city. People expect you to get stuff done. And all you have going on is a city manager in City Hall who's trying to block those initiatives and get their own policies put in place, even though they haven't been elected by anybody in the city other than five members of a nine-member council. So, yeah, the Portland Chamber has been very problematic. And they spent almost $1 million to defeat these referendum last fall. Wow. They were part of groups that spent almost $1 million. They were leading the charge on this. And, you know, they lost 4 out of 5 of them. They've been losing more elections. So hopefully with the Charter Commission, we'll have a real chance to push them out.
So as a history buff, I just have to ask you, what were the methods the KKK used to get when they got involved in the 20s? Was it voter intimidation? Did they actually use physical violence?
Well, look, when you march down the street in your hoods and you have rallies around the city, that's obviously intimidation. And I don't know the specific instances within that election, but they made very clear who they supported, which position they supported. And they did have rallies. There's, you know, very famous pictures of thousands of KKK members marching right down Congress Street, which is the main street in Portland, having rallies out in the Deering neighborhood. So there's no doubt that that's what was going on. But I think, you know, what they ultimately did was they hyped up the xenophobic fears, and they really just quietly, the way these organizations can, just whisper ear to ear to ear and tell folks who to vote for and say everything will be okay.
Massachusetts, we just recently had the ranked choice voting on our ballot, and it was defeated in one of our more recent state elections. Can you tell listeners what ranked choice voting is, why it matters, and what some of the benefits of having that system are?
Sure. Yeah, we've had ranked choice voting in Portland for the mayoral election. So I've been in three races with ranked choice voting used. And what it really does, and I'm going to say both the strengths and the weaknesses, right? Because I do think it's important. You know, it's not the be all and the end all. And I think that's part of our problem. You got to get clean elections in place. You got to have more voter access, all kinds of stuff. But what it allows for is to make sure that nobody gets elected with less than 50% of the vote. Because when you become an elected official, it's very important that you have a mandate, not simply for your own mindset, but for those around you to recognize that, hey, I'm here with over 50% of the voters who put me here. And so we need to try to move the agenda that they've asked me to move. And ranked choice voting simply allows you, you know, to rank your top candidates, 1, 2, 3, 4. And if your first choice candidate, you know, isn't getting enough votes, then your second choice candidate may be able to get enough votes to ultimately win. And it is a very effective tool to make sure that the person who gets elected gets the 50% of the vote. Now, what I would say, the one weakness with it, and I've said this to other communities, is if you have 15 people running or something, it becomes very hard for the electorate to really kind of get an idea. And so in that instance, what I would say is use your ranked choice voting and then take your top three and have a real runoff with those top three, kind of like we saw in Georgia. But I'd have the real runoff on the November election day when you'd have the highest turnout. And I would do the top three or top four so that you can still use ranked choice ultimately. But you really then give voters an opportunity to say, okay, we've now gone through the 15. We've got the three that we really want to listen to. Let's listen to those three and understand their visions and make a determination. I think that's the one amendment I'd make to it, but I would encourage cities to use it because it's better than simply using a primary system. We only have two, and in the end, you don't get a chance to, you know, a spoiler candidate can really ruin.
Great. Thank you. That's a really comprehensive explanation of that. Why do you think Portland's had such success with making the progressive gains you mentioned? You know, what's different about Portland when we look at other cities of similar size in New England?
I think the reason we've had success you know, in the last 4 or 5 years is we really took the power into our own hands. You know, we went to the ballot box. When I was mayor, we had great success in terms of education. We had the largest increases in our school budget that we'd had in generations. We passed the largest bond in the city in order to rebuild our elementary schools. We passed a very significant pesticide ban. We got property tax relief for seniors, on and on. And the reason we were able to do that is because there really were groups like Progressive Portland that I mentioned earlier who put a lot of effort into trying to lobby council and pesticide groups. And we have a great group of folks, environmental folks out there, who really helped to make sure the council did the right thing on that. And but we didn't get everything through. You know, we tried to pass paid sick days and we lost that vote 5-4. And, you know, that was pre-pandemic. And I'll bet some of those councilors wish they had those votes back now because they realize their constituents desperately need paid sick days, especially now. So we had a, you know, we really ratcheted up the amount of pressure that the public was putting on the council. And then since I left City Hall, we've, you know, we, like I said, we took power into our own hands and went to the ballot box and said, if the council won't do this stuff, we're going to bring it to see if the people want it. And look, I'm not an advocate of governing by referendum. I don't think it's the best way to create good legislation. But it is an imperative tool, both to leverage political bodies to do the right thing, but also if they don't do the right thing or they don't do enough, to then get to the ballot box and put pressure on to do more. And pretty much everything that we put on the ballot this year was stuff that we had brought forward to the council already and that they rejected. Right? I brought forward rent control to the council, brought forward 90-day notice, or increasing the amount of affordable housing developers have to build, or raising the minimum wage, or any of these issues, you know, stronger Airbnb, and the council didn't do them. So that's why I felt comfortable saying, okay, look, the council won't do it. It's like when we passed gay marriage in the state of Maine in 2012, we knew the only way to get it done was through referendum, because we had to get it to the public, because the legislature just wasn't, the legislature had done it in 2009, a big people's veto happened, that went out. We just knew the legislature was not going to have the courage to do it again, so we went to the ballot box. But again, you go to the legislative body first, you try to get the legislative body to do the right thing, or at least compromise and do something. And if they don't, then I think it's a very viable, very important part of our democracy to be able to go to the ballot.
So I'm told by a member of our podcast team, C Money, you've spoken with him, that NIMBYism is a bit of a problem in Portland. He named a couple issues, and I think the biggest one he named was the moving of one of your most central, your largest homeless shelters out to the outskirts of the city, and making those services really difficult to access, and for the folks staying there to access other things in the city. Is that, you know, what's going on with that NIMBYism, and like, how do you combat that, or how are you planning to work against that?
Yeah, I mean, this issue was there when I was the mayor, and we fought very hard to try to stop it. Again, we lost a 5-4 vote to try to stop this from happening. But as you described it, basically our biggest homeless shelter that serves the most people is right downtown where other services are, right downtown where other jobs are, right downtown where food is. Exactly where it should be, right downtown where people are. And for a long time, there have been people trying to get that shelter out of downtown because they want to develop that property. They want the property values to go up. And so the council has finally took the action to close the shelter downtown and literally move it to the, you could not be more on the edge of Portland with the next community, which is Westbrook. I mean, it is literally on the border. And, you know, that's 6 miles out of town, right? Out of downtown. Half hour bus ride, you know, if with normal traffic. There actually is no bus line out there now. They will try to get one out there for sure. But it's way back on this, like, industrial road. Just a terrible idea. And interestingly, again, because we've pushed very hard. And look, there are some NIMBYs who don't want it because they don't want a shelter in their neighborhood. But there are also a lot of people who are just like, look, this is not a good way to do this. And even at the time, I said, look, I'd be happy to have a shelter in that neighborhood, out in that area, but it shouldn't be the major shelter that serves the most people. You want to have a 30 or 40 bed shelter for domestic violence victims or for veterans or for mental health. But that totally makes sense. We should have shelters all over the city serving different needs. Sometimes some of those shelters really do need privacy, do need, you know, some of the domestic violence shelters we have in the city of Portland, you don't even know where they are because you have to protect the women that are sleeping in those rooms. But this shelter is too big, right? It's massive. Hundreds of people out on the edge of town, not going to be able to access the services they need. And now there is a referendum that's possibly going to be put on the ballot to actually say, you can't build any shelters in Portland that are bigger than 40 or 50 beds all throughout the city. And, you know, I don't know that it's the right answer to say that you shouldn't have any shelters that are bigger because you may need some that are bigger. But this is a response to the council not listening to the community again. Right. If we leave the shelter where it is or build a bigger shelter right where it is, it's already there. It's where it should be. And then we build additional shelters. We can do that around the city, and we should. And we should have them all over the city. I'm told, you know, there should be a 40 or 50 bed shelter in every council district, every one. And that way you'd start to actually meet the needs of the homeless population because, you know, we have 500-600 people a night who are looking for a bed, and we simply don't have enough beds for them at the moment with the kind of shelter that we currently have and the kind of shelter system that we currently have.
Sure. So how active have you been with your local chapter of DSA, Democratic Socialists of America?
I became more active after I left City Hall. I was a member, and I went to a few of the meetings. And I will tell you, my biggest frustration was that I would go to DSA meetings, and there would be, you know, 50 to 100 people at the meeting. And I was like, this is great. You've got incredible activism or incredible motivation. But when an issue came up in front of the council, like two people would show up. And there, it, you know, from my perspective in that work, and mine was myopic and focused on City Hall, there was a lot more talking than there was action. And I really was like, look, I'm happy. I want to do more action. So one person who was involved with DSA said, well, why don't you come to our annual meeting and we're going to start, you know, having some conversation about electoral strategy. And I said, okay. So I came to that, and that's where we began this process of creating these referenda. And since then, I've obviously been very active. And, you know, it is important to note that People First Portland is a broader coalition than simply Southern Maine DSA, as it should be. Like with most of these movements, this is how you do good work. You build coalitions. And obviously, you know, there are some people who don't ascribe to what DSA ascribes to, but they do like the referendum. You know, there's a lot of labor groups out there who definitely aren't socialists, right? They're labor guys. So they support some of the policies here, and they were certainly willing to support them. But they're not necessarily socialists or democratic socialists or however you want to define it. So we created People First Portland to say, look, this is for anybody who wants to focus on these issues. And so we got women's groups in there, workers' groups in there, labor groups in there, some environmental groups in there. Everybody came in. And that is really the kind of work that I love, is that kind of coalition work. And it's similar with what we're doing with People First Portland. Sorry, People First Charter right now. But so in the last couple of years, I've been very active through People First Portland in the work of Southern Maine DSA. And I feel like it's, you know, really, really put Portland on the map in terms of the kind of progressive change that we can create.
So it's interesting you bring up the fact that there is kind of that springing into action once you brought up electoralism. You know, there's been some criticism, and this is admittedly online on the, you know, left Twitter.
Yeah.
So let's take it with a grain of salt. But that people see themselves being left of DSA, or saying that what DSA does wrong is they're kind of getting candidates into the Democratic Party to get them elected. And then once that happens, you know, those candidates lose their edge, lose their focus on, you know, really fundamentally socialist issues. Is that something that you've seen, or is that a criticism that you would also levy at DSA?
I would... I mean, look, in terms of my political identity, first and foremost, I'm a Democrat, right? I've been a Democrat my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I would level that criticism at the Democratic Party, right? Because the Democratic Party, we constantly say we believe in something, and then we elect people. And, you know, the city council is all Democrats. And I couldn't get a body of 9 people who are all registered Democrats to vote for paid sick leave. I mean, what am I? a body of all Democrats voted to cut the school budget by $1.2 million or voted for corporate welfare. So somebody, you know, build a road to somebody's development, all on the tab of taxpayers. Right. So that's where I get from. I think it is inevitable that within any party, whether it's DSA or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, I'm sure too, people get elected and then they don't stay close to the values of what the Democratic Party stands for. You know, I mean, $15 an hour. Right? Joe Biden supports $15 an hour. And the entire city council, no, sorry, eight members of the city council, all of whom were Democrats, came out against $15 an hour, came out against our referendum. So that to me, that is a problem that always exists. But I will say to folks, look, I think that third parties are great. I think if folks want to create a third party and run people on that, you know, run people on that ticket, awesome. Nothing wrong with that. I think what we fail to remember, no matter what, is once we get people elected, you have to stay on them, right? The fight to create policy change does not end on election day, right? Joe Biden, I'll give him credit, he's pushing for $15 an hour. But Joe Biden's not going to get $15 an hour across the finish line unless a lot of people in this country start making a lot of noise. We've made enough noise that from 2016 to 2020, $15 an hour is the mainstream Democratic policy. But we haven't made enough noise at this point to get it mandated federally. And so if we don't stay on our elected officials, that's our failure. If our elected officials drift, we have to stay on them. And I would say forever and a day, every left-leaning organization should be getting involved in electoral politics and should be trying to pull people to the policies that they believe in. And whether that's electing candidates or whether it's referenda, whatever it is, you've got to keep focusing on the ultimate policy. And once you get people in office, stay on them. Give them the support they need. Call them constantly. My best achievements as mayor occurred because people packed City Hall to come and testify and say, you have got to rebuild our elementary schools. Our elementary schools are falling apart. And after over 10, maybe 15 years of trying to get the council to pass a bond to rebuild our schools, we finally did it. And that was because people showed up. We elected a mayor who was going to champion it, and people showed up. That's what got it done. So if your candidates aren't sticking with you after you elect them, you got to look in the mirror and you got to say, okay, yes, sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes you endorse somebody that you shouldn't have endorsed. Other times, you got to understand your job is to stay and keep helping.
So you would give the same advice to folks who are frustrated about, like, for instance, AOC. this is actually ridiculous, but not getting Medicare for All passed, or at least not getting a floor vote on Medicare for All. Or, for instance, canceling student loan debt. You'd say that energy needs to come from the people. It needs to bubble up, and it needs to politicians need to hear that in order for them to be motivated to act on it.
Sure. I mean, 100%. I mean, AOC is one of 435.
Right.
And AOC can, I'm sure, influence a dozen members of that body, maybe a few more. Mm-hmm. But there's two paths. Get more people elected who are committed to Medicare for All, and or put pressure on those who are already elected to get them in that position and make it clear that they'll be voted out of office. Look, the NRA has been controlling the gun debate in this country because they are very clear. We will take you out if you don't do what we want, right? It's not that they go around saying, oh, this is good policy. Don't you think this is the right thing we ought to do, et cetera? And, oh, we'll support you if we do the right thing, but if you do the wrong thing, well, okay, fine. We will take you out. And that's how they, you know, and marriage equality became a little bit about that. I served on the board of Equality Maine. And it's one of the things that we started to recognize. We had to be hard about issues around marriage equality. You're with us on this issue or not. And if you're not with us, we're going to tell people about it. And I think it helped to move. Yes, you have to move the populace. You got to have emotion. You got to make sure that people believe in what you believe in. But electoral politics, you have got to be clear. Get focused on the issue that's most important to you. Help people win who are with you. Get rid of people who don't.
Okay, so for listeners who like what they heard and they want to support People's First Portland, get involved in some way, what can they do?
You can certainly go to our website. You can make a donation. You know, if you're outside of the city, we would love to have your financial support so that we can really try to spread the word. PeopleFirstPortland.org. You can go to that. You can find us on ActBlue, PeopleFirstPortland.org, or PeopleFirstPortland, or PeopleFirstCharter. Look for our materials on that. That's the best way to help. If you are in the city of Portland and you want to start volunteering, same thing. You can go to our website and try to find a way. You know, we are going to need a lot of people on the ground to be able to pass out flyers and be able to put mailers in people's mailboxes and make phone calls and texting and all the stuff we have to do. So please step up if you want to volunteer. We'd love to have your support. The election's on June 8th, and it's coming faster than you realize.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk. It was a lot of fun having this conversation.
Great. Thanks. I really appreciate it, too. Nice to meet you.
You too. Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message at 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.